As you're aware, this year in Australia we're marking the 95th anniversary of Gallipoli, and I just wondered if you could tell me how the Australian experience in World War One, and particularly Gallipoli, came to such a prominent place in our history. What's your take on that?
I think the example of Australian experiences in Gallipoli in particular, and World War One generally, were really inscribed with a level of significance almost immediately that I think is quite telling in terms of conceptions of Australian identity. And the chief architect of this was the official war historian C.W. Bean, who very quickly sought to inscribe Gallipoli as a founding moment of Australian identity. It was a point, Gallipoli specifically, but also more generally, Australian experiences in World War One was a point where Australia took its place alongside, for Bean, the group of civilised nations who'd experienced war. It was almost a point where Australia became a legitimate nation. But it was also, for Bean, the qualities displayed by Australian soldiers at Gallipoli in particular that, for him, captured some dimension of the Australian spirit, certainly a fierce egalitarianism, but also courage in the face of adversity, solidarity. Notions of mateship were inscribed very quickly onto the experience of Gallipoli and in general World War One. And for a nation that was struggling to find its place in the world, those notions of nationhood and the notions of the central quality of the digger were very quickly taken up. So it wasn't by the early 1920s. Billy Hughes was campaigning for Anzac Day to be a national holiday. Certainly this was taken up by the RSL, and by the late 1920s, Anzac Day was a national holiday. And I think a lot of this is about the political interests of a range of actors in creating the Gallipoli experience as a founding moment of an Australian identity. And because of the particular context of Australia at the time, a nation looking for a sense of self, it really resonated with a lot of people.
I'm just wondering, with the egalitarianism of the Australian troops in Gallipoli in particular and World War One in general, is that more a sense that it wasn't as hierarchical an army as, say, the British Army? Is that exactly what that would mean?
That's right. Certainly the stereotypical Australian soldier was one who was loath to salute, for example, British officers, had a healthy, what's been reinscribed as a healthy disrespect for authority. And I think a lot of this was in part an attempt to reconcile Australia's past, its convict heritage, in such a way as to say, well, actually, this notion that we are all equal in some way minimises the stain of the convict past, as well as is a way of turning that into a set of positive qualities associated with notions of equality. And it's actually been something that a range of political leaders have seized upon. Certainly it was quite prominent in Paul Keating's interpretation of the Anzac tradition and the experience at Gallipoli.
Which leads us to the question of how Paul Keating as Prime Minister and then John Howard as Prime Minister had differing views of the Gallipoli experience and the Anzac tradition and how that shaped their sense of Australia's place in the world. Can we go to that quite recent history?
One thing that's quite interesting, despite very different political projects in many ways, both exhibited a willingness to tie the Anzac tradition generally and the particular experience of Gallipoli to a notion of a kind of nationalist expression of Australian identity. For Paul Keating, the emphasis was on the experience of Gallipoli was one that should be. What we should take away from Gallipoli was a sense of betrayal by British troops in the context of a conflict, most importantly, that simply wasn't ours, that we were fighting on behalf of others. And so for that reason, Paul Keating relatively recently poured scorn on those who were visiting Gallipoli in so-called pilgrimages, suggesting that the notion that Australia was founded through its experience of Gallipoli was questionable, to say the least, and emphasised by contrast that the Anzac tradition should be more tied to the historical experience and on the Kokoda track when Australian soldiers were actually protecting the Australian mainland from invasion. So for him it was very much tied to a notion, the Anzac tradition in general, he sought to tie to a broader identity project that was about reorienting Australia away from traditional allies, in part through using the example of Gallipoli to say, well, not only are they not the most important sets of allies for us now, that even in our founding myths, They weren't necessarily there for us when we needed them, if you like. For John Howard, the representation of the core values of the Anzac myth and even the qualities displayed by diggers was actually relatively consistent. Notions of mateship, of solidarity, even elements of egalitarianism have been emphasised by John Howard in his representation. But what he sought to do was refocus on Gallipoli as the founding moment and suggest that the experience of Australian soldiers fighting alongside our traditional allies actually was a moment that inscribed the core values that we shared with those allies, both in the UK and in the US, and in our experiences in World War One and in World War Two. We'd shared these core values that had seen us go to war and seen us fight shoulder to shoulder with great and powerful friends, and those notions were very prominent in Howard's conception of Australian identity that was very much about tying Australia back to culturally similar nations that shared historical experiences with whom we could feel comfortable. And again, that was very much tied to John Howard's broader identity project. So in both you see this conception that Gallipoli itself and the meanings that we attach to the experience of Gallipoli, even the way we remember Gallipoli, is very much tied and part and parcel of a broader identity project, a broader conception of who Australians are and what we value.
In a sense, John Howard sounds like he recaptured the historian Bean's official rendering. It sounds like there's very little difference in those two perspectives. Would that be a fair comment?
Certainly John Howard's always been accused of an old nationalism, an older version of Australian nationalism that harked back to Australia's past and notions of this cultural, historical proximity or ties to Britain. So it's not surprising that C.W. Bean and John Howard shared a similar conception, if you like, of these innate qualities that demonstrated the closeness of ties. But the particular meaning attached to the shared experience in conflict certainly became more prominent in John Howard's rendering of the Gallipoli experience as events unfolded after September 11 that meant that it became more of an issue, the need to justify levels of cooperation with the United States and the United Kingdom as well.
Let's have a look at that progress, though, within John Howard's prime ministership, because when he began, you've made a point in your paper that he had a defence policy that was differently focused than what necessarily then developed. So can we have a look at that?
In the first white paper, in 1997, the Foreign Affairs and Trade white paper, there was a very strong emphasis on the idea of a foreign policy that was about a hard-headed assessment of the national interest. And clearly this was in contrast to the so-called good international citizenship of the Labor government. But it was very much tied to a tradition that was about a rational assessment of Australia's national interest in contrast to some idea of a commitment to internationalism for its own sake. By 2003, we see a reorientation in the next Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade white paper. We see a real emphasis on core values that underpin notions of the national interest. And certainly this period coincided with one where John Howard was becoming more and more interventionist in terms of debates about Australian culture and identity, was demonstrating more and more of a willingness to intervene in, say, questions about history and the teaching of history or the composition of the Australian War Memorial. At various levels, there seemed to be a willingness to engage more in a cultural building project within Australia itself. But certainly the events of September 11 shifted that focus in foreign policy and meant that actually it was a little bit difficult, certainly with intervention in Iraq, to reconcile a hard-headed assessment of Australia's immediate national interests with participation in military intervention in Iraq. I think that was difficult to do. And so John Howard attempted to reorient, in a way, foreign policy away from this conception of a purely instrumental, rational assessment of the national interests and towards a conception of foreign policy that was about recognising the values that Australia should be promoting in its participation in foreign policy. For scholars of international relations, it might almost be a shift from a realist conception of foreign policy to almost a neoconservative one, at least in terms of the primacy given to values and at least the recognition of the possibility of advancing those values through participation in military conflict.
Can we just clarify a bit further? If John Howard's initial foreign policy objectives were to protect the national interest for Australia rather than some sort of more ideologically broad international player role, then how do the values of Gallipoli fit with that? Are they just focusing on the internal nature of Australia as an egalitarian, mateship-focused culture? Then we have the massive shift after 9/11 where you're out in the international arena again, but in a very specific way. Let's just go over that a bit more, please.
Well, certainly the argument could be made that, in a sense, the fundamental commitment to the US alliance didn't shift. And in a sense, John Howard's view of the centrality of the Gallipoli experience, Australian participation in World War One, and the significance of that participation, and the values, the qualities displayed by the diggers in World War One, the centrality of that to Australian identity didn't really shift for John Howard. I think what did shift was the willingness to link those identity narratives, if you like, to foreign policy more directly. And that's what actually shifted. In part, that was enabled through the change in rhetoric in the United States towards a very value-laden conception of American foreign policy and indeed the way the world should operate that allowed states like Australia to reorient their values somewhat. But arguably also this was part of the shift in language was part of a shift from Howard in terms of the recognition of the need to find ways to communicate to the Australian people in the context of a new US administration that was after September 11 very much focused on questions of foreign and security policy. I think we can certainly see, for example, the use of, at a very general level, we see a lot of the same representations in terms of the need for Australia to participate in military intervention in the war on terror. We see a lot of continuity between what's at stake, what types of values Australia should demonstrate in its foreign policy, and the traditional meaning given to the Anzac tradition, for example, or the qualities displayed by diggers. We need to stand shoulder to shoulder with allies on the battlefield as we did in the world wars. We need to demonstrate mateship towards other culturally similar, great and powerful friends. Solidarity, courage was certainly invoked through the idea that Australia has always been a country prepared to fight its own fights. So at a very general level, we see a range of representations of the need for Australian participation in military intervention in the war on terror that are quite similar to the values that are traditionally given to the Anzac tradition. But more directly, John Howard invoked the experience of diggers at Gallipoli and in World War One in such a way as to suggest that the values they were fighting for were ultimately the same values. And we saw speeches to troops on Anzac Day in Iraq in 2004, for example. The speech he gave at the funeral of the last digger, Alec Campbell, in many ways attempted to say the values that the diggers fought for in World War One are the values at stake in the war on terror. And there was a clear need to fight alongside our great and powerful friends to protect those values in the context of the war on terror. Certainly the Howard government marginalised opposition to political opposition, especially to military intervention in Iraq in a range of ways. I think we can talk, for example, about the ways in which actually parliamentary debate was enabled and some of the processes put in train there, some of the ways in which opponents of intervention were demonised, as in the case of the French, as being resentful of US power, for example, or in the Australian context of opponents as being somehow supportive of the Saddam Hussein regime, as evidence of the willingness of John Howard to marginalise opponents. But at a more general level, but no less powerful, the willingness to tie core Australian values to military intervention in Iraq, to suggest that what it is, that the essence of Australianness is at stake in us participating in military intervention in Iraq, it certainly makes contestation difficult lest you be seen as un-Australian. And I think that's a particularly powerful way of marginalising dissent. It's less direct than limiting, than directly limiting the space for contestation, but it has the same effect.
What sort of effect has it had on Prime Minister Rudd's premiership? I mean, where are we at now in terms of how you believe he's inherited, disputed, varied or copied the John Howard approach? Are there points there?
Early on, Kevin Rudd certainly represented the central themes of the Anzac tradition and even the significance of Gallipoli in very similar ways to John Howard. I think that the really interesting question is, does Kevin Rudd genuinely believe in the significance of that event and those values, or is he constrained by what he perceives to be a cultural context in which those ideas are very, very embedded, sedimented, resonant in the Australian context? John Howard has, in a range of ways, I think, made it difficult to contest the centrality of the Gallipoli experience, has made it difficult to contest the centrality of particular sets of values to what it means to be Australian. And in more general terms, has created a context in which quite a nationalist celebration of Australianness, arguably a narrow, based on a narrow conception of Australian identity, has become dominant in the Australian context. I think we all see more Australian flags and the Southern Cross around than we used to, and we see slogans like Australia, love it or leave it. I think it's very difficult to understand those changes without understanding the legacy, the cultural, social and political legacy left by John Howard. So even given the political will to articulate alternative conceptions of Australian values or to articulate the centrality of other stories in the Australian experience, it would be very difficult for Prime Minister Rudd in an immediate sense to articulate radical alternatives, I think.
In your paper, you write about bravery and also trauma and betrayal. What are the issues of interest to you there?
One of the central themes in studies of memory is the theme of trauma. And trauma, I think, can be understood, and I'm borrowing from a colleague, Dr. James Brassett from the University of Warwick, understands trauma as an event where our lives or the lives of those close to us is threatened, where we don't have control over the ways in which they're threatened and which there's a fundamental sense of vulnerability associated with that, where we find that the traditional agents or institutions upon which we relied for protection, for example, aren't able to provide us with that protection. And I think we can already see the parallels of some of those themes to Gallipoli, and particularly the narrative that suggests it was Britain's war at a general level in which we were participating, but also that British officers sent Australians to their death needlessly at Gallipoli. And this is certainly quite apparent in a range of popular cultural representations of the experience at Gallipoli. So it was quite a resonant idea. But I think in terms of trauma, there are choices there about how we respond to trauma. And one of the choices would be to embrace that vulnerability and to ask what it means at a fundamental level to be so vulnerable. And in a sense, part of Paul Keating's representation of Gallipoli is about saying, let's recognise this vulnerability and think about what this means in terms of Australia's role in the world and the types of relationships we should form with other states, that we were somehow abandoned by the British in World War One, and this should underpin the way we think about our national interests in the contemporary setting. But inscribing very positive notions of bravery, of heroism, of sacrifice to those things is another response that enables us in some way to elide or to downplay notions of vulnerability. And this isn't at any level to suggest that participants at Gallipoli didn't display bravery, courage, sacrifice in the face of a situation that most of us can't even imagine. But it is to suggest that when we do focus on that sense of trauma, of vulnerability, when we respond to trauma in such a way as to say this demonstrated all these positive qualities, it arguably valorises the military and a sense of participation in war as central to what it is to be Australian. And that, I think, is potentially problematic
You talk about memory in the response you've just given me, and your paper talks about memory politics, which is a whole area of research within international relations and other disciplines. But is there anything more you want to say more generally about memory politics?
I think at its most general, I think memory politics is about the process of contestation over what we remember, over how we remember and who we remember. And these things, I think the example of the different interpretations of Gallipoli by Paul Keating and John Howard demonstrate what's at stake in debates about historical events and collective memory. But too often, I think, we might focus on the questions of how memory is used politically by people like Prime Minister Howard to justify military intervention, for example. There's a very strategic conception of the use of memory that has generally characterised the way we think about memory politics. But another and crucial dimension of this is the ways in which resonant, sedimented notions of collective memory actually provide limits or constraints on what political leaders are able to say and do. And the example of Kevin Rudd's inheritance, I think, of the centrality of a particular memory of Gallipoli is evidence of the ways in which memory can serve to constrain as well as to enable politically. And I think together we get a sense of the ways in which the most effective forms of memory politics, if you like, are employed by political leaders. We can't make sense of, say, the success of the Howard government in linking military intervention to the values on display at Gallipoli or the significance historically of Gallipoli and that memory without also understanding how John Howard played a role in creating, a central role in creating a social and cultural context in Australia in which that invocation of a particular memory would resonate and be politically effective.
So in your paper, you do talk a lot about the sort of thing, obviously, you're saying now, but it's specifically about the process of remembering and forgetting. So say a bit more about that.
I think one of the core contributions of a focus on memory, one of the things that it does give us as opposed to a focus on, say, the use of history or narratives of identity, which are more familiar to certainly to scholars of international relations, one of the useful things about memory is that it's so dynamic and living and in the moment. So we see in terms of processes and practices of remembrance and commemoration, the sites and the rituals of that. There's a politics to that, and there are dynamics whereby the way we celebrate, the way we give meaning to that, to past experience through contemporary forms of commemoration, I think, is also significant in terms of what's potentially forgotten or excluded from celebrations, if you like, of what it means to be Australian. So using the example of Gallipoli, we might say that the increasing attendance at Gallipoli, the organisation of tours to Gallipoli for backpackers organised by organisations that would usually be organising sporting trips for Australians, you know, where we see these young white Australians attending dawn services at Gallipoli. Effective, though that is at an emotional level, and while certainly John Howard was very eager to represent those types of dynamics as relatively organic as happening because Australians began to recognise this sense of what it means to be Australian. I think in some sense the commemoration of Gallipoli has become really quite nationalist and arguably tied increasingly to a notion of real values being inscribed, founded through participation in war. And at both those levels, there is a fundamental problem, I think, with associating the commemoration of a tragic loss of life to a positive inscription of what it means to be Australian, or at least we should be aware of the dangers associated with remembering in that way and remembering this particular story and these particular people instead of other stories and instead of other people. It does arguably valorise a military tradition, and it does arguably feed into quite a narrow conception of Australian national identity. I think one of the most fundamentally difficult things about the politics of memory is that while we see scholars, for example, of international relations saying we should forget the experience of September the 11th because it's the response to it is so heavily inscribed with the war on terror, those who have ideological problems with the war on terror have advocated in international relations scholarship that we should actually move away from commemoration and remembrance of September 11 as an event because we can get stuck in negative dynamics of how we respond to it. I wouldn't want to forget the experience of those who died in World War One or downplay the significance that that memory has at a cultural level for Australians, and the types of values we ascribe to it aren't necessarily problematic. But I think what we need to do is be aware of the politics involved in remembering, of what we remember, of who we remember, of how we remember. We need to be aware of the implications of attaching particular types of significance to particular events and the ways in which that can then provide ballast to be used for ends that we might not be that happy with.